summer wind came blowing in from across the sea and lingered there so warm and fair to walk with me. All summer long we sang a song and strolled on golden sand. Two sweethearts and the summer wind. Like painting kites, those days and nights went flying by. The world was new beneath the blue umbrella sky. Then softer than a piper man, one day it called to you. And I lost you to the summer.
You're listening to 101.9 CITR FM in Vancouver. This is Inkstuds. I'm feeling weird with my mic. It's all around. There we go. That's better. Hoo-wah. Whoever had it backwards.
Am I on?
You're on. Oh, there we go. Don's on.
I'm
okay.
On.
Inkstuds, okay. CITR 101.9 FM, the show where we talk about comics. And we are joined this week by Mr. Gary Groth and Mr. Kim Thompson. Do we have you both?
We are here. Glad to be on the show.
Excellent. We're joined both Gary and Kim, the founders, publishers, editors, and wearers of many hats of Fantagraphics, the top in comics goodness, I guess is the best way to put it. So originally we're going to have you on and kind of discuss a little bit about what's happening with Fantagraphics right now, but it seems that things are probably settling a little. I guess listeners or comics aficionados know about the lawsuit that was happening with Harlan Ellison, but we're not going to discuss that so much, I guess. Well, I'll talk a little bit about history stuff. So I guess first off, congratulations on 30 years of comics journal. Is it 31 years now this year?
Well, it's going on 31. This 07 will be the 31st year.
Okay. Well, 31 years is still a pretty darn good benchmark.
And I've only been here for 30 years, so it's my 30th anniversary.
And I was actually just reading the biography that you guys are slowly putting out on the website, and you're at about August was when you guys first met. Am I correct?
That sounds about right, yeah.
Yeah, if it says, definitely if it says so, it's got to be true.
Now, maybe we can, you can tell people about how you guys first met.
Kim, you want to do that?
Yeah, let me think back. Gary, of course, had co-founded the Comics Journal and Fantagraphics with his partner Mike Catron in 1976. And in 1977, I arrived in the Washington, D.C. area, which is where they were located. I had spent pretty much all my childhood in Europe or other parts, even more unknown, and my parents had just returned to the United States. At the time, I was 21 years old. So I was just sort of poking around, trying to figure out what I want to do with my life, and I happened to run into Gary through mutual acquaintance. And at that point, I thought it would be fun to join and work on the Comics Journal. And that's how it happened.
Okay, so originally...
Oh, and my co-host, Don King.
Hi.
I'll introduce him.
Hi.
So originally it was just before it became Fantagraphics. But was it Fantagraphics from the beginning, or was it just the Comics Journal?
It was Fantagraphics from the beginning. Fantagraphics was the corporate name under which Comics Journal was published.
Oh, okay, yeah, I always wondered about that.
It was the Fantastic Fanzine, am I correct?
Yeah, right. I think that's where it came from. I remember I used the name Fantagraphics as far back as a few things I published when I was in college, and that would have been around 72.
It's very much the kind of name that a 13-year-old would come up with.
Oh!
And it, yeah, but it stuck.
It stuck, yeah. Well, it's like Smuckers. With a name like that, it's got to be good.
Now, originally with the journal, I guess it started out as the Nostalgia Journal previous, and you kind of... Gary, you took it over.
Yeah, it was being published as the Nostalgia Journal by a group of fans in Texas, and it was essentially what was called an ad zine, which was primarily a magazine or tabloid, you know, devoted to advertising with little editorial content sprinkled in. And we took it over in '76 and basically transformed it. What we were interested in originally, Mike Catron and I. Was editorial content, and so we thought our theory was that if we built up the editorial content, we would simultaneously build up the advertising revenue, and that worked to a limited but insufficient extent. And about 7 or 8 or 9 issues into it, we changed the name to the Comics Journal, and then changed the format from a tabloid to a magazine size so that we could get distributed into comic stores.
Now, when the journal left, like, I was only familiar with it since it became a magazine.
Right. But you're not ancient.
Yeah. Well, I'm getting there. But I think, as far as I can tell, it was the first, I guess, for lack of a better word, fanzine that was that had any sort of
criticism.
Criticism. Yeah.
No, there were predecessors. There was. There were a number of good. Fan magazines prior to the journal. Not many, but some. One was Graphic Story Magazine.
Oh, yeah.
Which was published by Bill Spicer on the West Coast. There was Graphic Story World. They were all named Graphic Story Something. Graphic Story World was published by a guy named Richard Kyle. And these were just intelligent fans who were probably older than I was. I started publishing a fanzine when I was, I think, 14. And so these guys were older than I was and more sophisticated, and they actually were putting out, you know, a pretty decent fan magazine about comics. There was another magazine called Inside Comics, which was edited by Joe Brancatelli. So there were definitely predecessors to the journal, but probably not any magazines that were quite as tenacious about it.
Yeah.
The journal.
And that was that's something I'm curious about is the interest of, like, Some of your early intentions, I guess, was it to just promote as a kind of critical form, kind of give people another way of looking at comics?
Yeah. I mean, we wanted to impose journalistic and critical standards on the comics profession and on the art form. And I think that was our mandate and our mission. And we also, I think, wanted to be confrontational about it. Prior to the journal, most fanzines, I mean, the vast majority of fanzines were, you know, really just gee whiz, you know, fannish stuff that just did nothing but heap praise on favorite cartoonists and, you know, in print sort of silly articles about superheroes. And, you know, it was all very, very fan-oriented. And we wanted to, you know, practice real journalism and publish serious criticism about comics and just move comics or move the perception of comics from sort of a minor pop culture item into a more serious form of art.
That's something I'm interested about because you're very critical of comics, and much to the dismay of a lot of readers through history of reading it. And kind of I'm curious, is that part of, I don't know, comics keeping itself ingrained as a pop culture thing?
Well, I don't, you know, I mean, in some ways, comics have caught up with the journal's critical agenda. I mean, you see comics are being reviewed in mass circulation magazines like Entertainment Weekly and Rolling Stone and you know, and smaller places like Rain Taxi, which is a literary magazine. So you see, you know, comics sort of growing up and becoming more a part of mainstream pop culture. Now, I think simultaneously, you know, pop culture itself has become, and critical discourse about it has become so degraded that I'm not sure it's a wash exactly, but both those two phenomena have been happening over the last 10, 20 years. And of course, having said that, I forgot what your actual question was.
One thing I want to add is it's kind of interesting. I was rereading the book of interviews, the writers that we did, which had several writers of comics from the early 80s. And at the time, there was an interview with a guy, I think it was Steve Englehart, who was
yeah.
a bright guy. And there was like a serious little discussion within the interview as to whether anyone would ever really be able to or willing to read a comic book that would be like more than 60 pages long.
Wow.
It was really, I mean, that was the angle from which people were coming at the time. It would be literally impossible for a comic to be as lengthy or as serious as a novel.
Yeah.
That the format itself was so inherently strange. I mean, it was sort of like, you know, a discussion of a century ago as to, you know, if a train started going more than 25 miles an hour, would people's heads blow off?
Yeah. Yeah, I was wondering, do you think of that a lot of the, like the, even the critical way of people of looking at
Don's sick.
I'm in the middle of a cold. Anyway, I was going to ask, but do you think the perception, even just from the people involved in comics has changed, maybe somewhat due to the sort of changing of the guard where the people that were in
growing
comics,
up,
like the people, basically, like in the 70s, it seemed that 90% of people that were in comics had been working in them since the 50s. And I wonder
yeah.
if that might have been attributing to that at all.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, the zeitgeist has shifted and people shift along with it. You know, I mean, the attitude among, I don't know, I mean, if you look at the Zap cartoonists, people like Robert Crumb and Gilbert Shelton and Victor Moscoso in Spain and so forth, I mean, they consider themselves artists in a way that mainstream cartoonists, people who were working for Marvel and DC and Archie and so forth, did not.
Uh-huh.
And I think you can see where their attitude, almost a self-consciousness about their status as an artist has spread to virtually every aspect of comics, whether it's earned or not.
Yeah, exactly.
We did wind up with an awful lot of Spider-Man artists convinced they were artists.
Yeah, so it's got an upside and a downside to it.
Yeah.
Now, that kind of bridges to, like, it started out, you published the journal, and then you, I guess, first published a couple of graphic novels, one of them being Comanche Moon by the...
Los Tejanos.
Close.
Yeah, sorry, I'm thinking of... We were talking about it on our way, but
yeah.
Jack Jackson, Los Tejanos, beautiful from the artwork I've seen. I don't actually have a copy.
I have it. It's awesome. It's my favorite Jack Jackson book. Was that one of your first forays into publishing?
Well, Jackson's, you know, I think Jackson's graphic novel, Los Tejanos, is the first comic we published once we started publishing the journal. And it was, you know, it was about 130, 140 pages. And Jack had done Comanche Moon, as you mentioned earlier, which was published, I think it was a joint production by two underground comics publishers.
I think it was, yeah, I think, wasn't it Last Gasp?
Yeah, I think so.
And Printman, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so he did his, you know, his second historical graphic novel, which was an historical piece of work. And we published that, I think we published it in 81, if I'm not mistaken. I think it was the first, you know, it was the first comic that we published. And then we went on to publish a couple of other comics, Milton Knight's Hugo, and we published a couple of issues of a book called Don Rosa's Comics and Stories.
Oh, yeah.
Don Rosa, who went on to do to draw a lot of Donald Duck material in the tradition of Karl Barks. And then in 82, we published Love and Rockets. I mean, a lot of people think that Love and Rockets was the very first comic we published, but we actually did publish a few things prior to that.
Now, one thing I was kind of leading into was it, it seems, you know, when you're not making a lot of money doing comics, you're very careful what you're publishing, and it seems what you were starting out with was kind of not really fitting into any of the, you know, slots of comics that people were used to dealing with. They weren't really undergrounds.
Yeah.
They weren't the Art Spiegelman super arty stuff, and I mean, they obviously weren't superheroes, and they weren't, you know, sword and sorcery fantasy stuff. Was that something you guys were seeing? There was a gap in comics, and it just needed to be filled?
I wish I could say it was that closely scrutinized an agenda, but I think that, you know, Jack got in touch with me, and I'd loved his work, and we just thought that it would be wonderful to publish him. And then after that, we met Milton Knight in New York. He was living in Manhattan at the time, and I think we met him through a mutual acquaintance. And he just showed us his work. I mean, these things just sort of fell into our lap, and they overlapped somehow with our sensibility or with what we, you know, wanted comics to become.
It was sort of a combination of whim and opportunity.
Yeah.
So that was something I was really curious about. Is the transfer from being, you know, from Critical Magazine to kind of, you know, the slow transition into really, I mean, Fantagraphics, people more know it for the comics, but the Comics Journal remains, I guess, like the flagship title for Fantagraphics.
Yeah, I mean, at the time, the Journal was sort of the springboard. I mean, everyone knew us from the Journal, and I think the Journal was hitting a certain level of notoriety, certainly through the 80s, that it hasn't had since.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and we actually started publishing a lot of cartoonists, you know, precisely because of the Journal. Either because cartoonists were aware of the Journal and approached us, or because I would interview, you know, a cartoonist and then get to know him, and then start publishing his work after that.
Yeah, it became almost a standing joke that Garrett would go out to interview some cartoonist and come back with the interview and a book publishing contract.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. Were there people that you met just through doing the Journal that, like, who impressed you the most out of some of the people that you met, like, that you maybe had no view on before you met them, and then when you met them, you actually...
Well, I mean, one artist I was in awe of for many years, even before we started publishing the Journal, was Ralph Steadman,
mm-hmm.
who I think you guys might have interviewed
yep.
on your show.
Yeah, yep. We're talking about that.
And so you know what a great guy he is.
Mm-hmm.
And I met him in L.A., and I don't remember the circumstance, but, you know, somehow I got in touch with him, and I met him in L.A., and we sat down and chatted for a little while, and he agreed to do an interview. And then I went over to England, and I did the first interview at his place in Kent. And then, of course, we did subsequently publish one of his books. We reprinted his Ralph Steadman's America.
Oh, yeah.
We reformatted it and reprinted it here. And I'm talking to Ralph now about maybe in 08 or 09 publishing a big Ralph Steadman sketchbook.
Oh, wow.
Oh, that would be awesome.
I think would be incredible.
Yeah.
And so, you know, he's a perfect example of somebody who I admired before I even started doing the Journal, and really never expected that I would, A, interview, or B, get to know. You know, I was familiar with his work through, of course, Hunter Thompson.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Hunter Thompson, you actually... brought to a convention in the 70s?
Yeah, it was pre-Comics Journal, and Mike Catron and I had this brilliant idea to make a lot of money that we could then start our publishing company with by putting on a rock and roll convention. And through the Rolling Stone Lecture Bureau, we got Hunter Thompson there. So I actually had to go out to his hotel and pick him up for reasons I don't understand, but apparently he was incapable of getting to our convention by himself. So I actually went out and got him and brought him to the convention, and he, you know, he spent a couple of hours speaking.
Oh, that's cool.
Now, was he kind of an influence for your own kind of critiquing style of, like, really just saying what's on your mind and just going out there and just doing it?
You know, I'm not sure I'd say influence, but it may be inspiration, that kind of nakedly honest, to hell with the consequences form of expression could be done.
Actually, one of the things that always stands out with the Journal was that I think you were – that was the first magazine I'd ever read not only criticism of comics and like critiques and things, but I think you might have been the only magazine that actually was critical of the people that people look up to as like these icons, like people like Art Spiegelman or whatever, or, you know,
Will Eisner
and people like that they're not infallible, you know.
Right.
Some people, I don't think, still want to admit that.
Yeah, we wanted to subtitle the magazine "No Sacred Cows."
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think that was important to us to adopt that attitude. That even, I mean, and you know, the conundrum is that we publish criticism about people that I like and I respect, and that I even disagree with. The criticism of. But we felt it should be a freewheeling magazine that wasn't afraid to do that.
Basically, the only quality you look for is in writing from and people pretty much free to speak their minds as writers for the Comics Journal.
Yeah, I mean, I think it has to be a defensible point of view. But I give it a lot of latitude within that parameter.
Actually, one thing I was going to mention, we were talking about the old Journal stuff, is that you guys were also, I thought it was admirable that you guys were kind of at the forefront of every sort of almost moral cause that would come up with regards to like original artwork and people getting compensated for old work and things like that, like the Superman, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster stuff and the Kirby artwork and all that. I don't think anybody else really took a stand on it as much as you guys did, outside of actual professionals.
Outside of Neil Adams?
Yeah.
that's why we were at the forefront, because there was actually no one else doing it.
Yeah, I always thought that was admirable, and I...
Well, thanks.
Yeah, I think I mentioned when I met you briefly in Seattle about how you guys, I always saw you guys as being like the Sylvia Beach of comic books, because you actually got to put your money where your mouth is, and
right.
You know, publish the stuff that you know, that was worth it, whether anybody else would or not, you know.
Well, thanks. I'm glad you said that. It would have been too serving for me to have said that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the end of my gushing for the hour.
Yeah,
now Gary can put down the cue card.
Yeah.
We are not a spokes show for Comics Journal or Fantagraphics. We're just appreciators.
Yeah.
Just to remind people, we're speaking with Gary Groth and Kim Thompson, co-publishers, editors, and men of many hats of Fantagraphics. One thing I've noticed going through my Fantagraphics books, it seems you both strong views in appreciation of comics and the type of stuff you're editing and stuff. Do you kind of take on different aspects of comics that you're interested in promoting with Fantagraphics?
You mean the two of us?
Yeah, the two of you, like, kind of like...
Individually.
Yeah, of your own personal interests of what you each want to kind of do and push out for goodness.
Probably.
I think we have different tastes and we have different skill sets. Obviously, almost all of the foreign books that we do, I tend to handle. And that's partly because that's the material I'm really familiar with, and partly just a pragmatic reason that I speak languages. So it makes sense for me to work on them.
How many languages do you actually speak?
That would be a simple question normally. Three fluently, a couple more I can work my way through, then I can read another four or five on a good day.
Wow. That's impressive.
Which comes in handy. I've actually used, I think, every single language that I can work my way through in one way or another, working at Fantagraphics, doing translations.
Oh, really?
I mean, it's not that often I get to translate a Dutch comic book, but still, it happens.
Well, you're doing a Joost Swart collection, isn't that coming out?
Exactly. In fact, that's the one.
Oh, right.
But I have translated Joost Swart before.
Okay. For Raw, or was it just other projects?
Actually, I did do a Raw story at one point. I know I've translated him before.
Yeah,
but we also did one of his kids' books for measles.
Hmm.
I did not know that.
Yeah, the Comics Journal was actually the first place I ever saw a Hugo Pratt story. You guys reprinted like a full, I think it was the Brazilian Eagle or something.
That's right, Comics Journal 108.
Yeah, there you go.
Milton Caniff cover.
Yeah.
Very well.
Yeah, that was like right when I read that, I thought, why have I never read this before? You know? Yeah, and to this day, you guys are still delving more and more into
history?
Yeah, or foreign translations and things. Like the Coconino line?
Right. The Ignatz line of comics, most of which are European. Yeah, absolutely. And frankly, in an ideal world, I'd be doing two or three times as much as we are doing, but there's a limit to what the market can absorb. And the foreign comics are actually very labor-intensive to do and don't sell that well. So it's, to a large degree, a labor of love. The exception being Jason, who actually is very easy to do because he's so succinct, and also he sells quite well.
And half his comics are silent.
Right, right. Although some are quite verbose.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that you, there was some, you guys, one of them was Lorenzo Mattotti.
Mm-hmm.
And, I almost never see anything by the guy, and I was just thrilled just to even see anything of his in print, you know.
I felt the same way.
Oh, yeah, he's one of the people. I mean, I have, you know, a dream list of 20 cartoonists at least that from Europe that I would love one day to do a book of, but I have to basically prioritize them.
Mm-hmm.
Mattotti is somewhere, you know, in the top six.
Yeah. Who else would make that make the cut? Anybody you care to mention?
Well, I would certainly like to do a big collection of Marti's work, for instance.
Mm, yeah.
That's very high on the list. There is some Hergé material, the guy who created Tintin, that's never been published in the U.S. That's also top of my list.
Mm.
There's a great South American cartoonist called Kino. Mm-hmm. That is sort of I've been sort of thinking about for a while, and it would be nice to get someone like Tardy back into print in the U.S. Although, as I've discovered, he's a very hard sell.
Oh, really?
And then on from there. And we also, I mean, I also at one point we were doing the Muñoz Sampaio Sinner material, mm-hmm. which is wonderful work, and I'd love to pick up that one again. So
Nicaragua.
Yeah, I actually found the one that surprised me the most was I picked up the I think it was the Innocence by GP.
Yeah.
Am I saying that right?
Yep.
GP. And I picked it up because of the artwork, and I read it, and I thought, this is fantastic, and I'd never read anything by the guy before. I thought
it's very strong, yeah. There's First Second put out a book of his.
The Rock Band.
The Grosch Band.
Yeah, and they have another one coming out. And in fact, I believe it was the second book in the series, They Found the Car, that got nominated for an Eisner.
So, oh, really?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's the art is so beautiful that you almost don't expect it to also be, you know, very smart and tightly written.
Exactly. Yeah, I was thrown.
Yeah, yeah. I'm really happy. That's one of my. Well, actually, I love pretty much all the Ignatz titles. I don't think there's a dud among them. But his work is certainly wonderful. And I mean, that's one of the fun things about working in the Ignatz is that at least half the cartoonists I'd never heard of before.
Yeah, and have they taken over for, or almost taken the place of sort of the traditional pamphlet comics from Fantagraphics? You guys don't really seem to be doing those sort of traditional...
I hate that term, pamphlet.
Well, I didn't know what else to call them. You know, comic books.
We call them that as well. Yeah, yeah. The alternative pamphlet is kind of dying out.
Yeah.
So the Ignatzes are like one instance of trying to find a happy medium between that and books, which really to some degree was that way was paved by... Dan Klaus's last issues of 8-Ball, for instance.
Oh, yeah.
Or, for that matter, the ever-growing Acme Novelty Library.
It's a great format. I like the large format. It's just nice. It's just like
it's a really nice format. Yeah, and it seems to be working okay.
Yeah, it looks a lot nicer in a bigger, closer look at. There's something else I was going to ask. I completely forgot what it was. One thing, a writer who I'm a big fan of, I'm just curious how you got him to do a comic for you guys, is Bukowski.
Bukowski, is that the
was that the Matthias Schultheis, a couple of winos?
Yes.
Well, I don't think that was so much a case of getting him to do it. I think that was just an adaptation of an existing story.
Yeah, he adapted short stories for Bukowski.
Oh.
Unfortunately, we didn't have any direct connection.
No.
Or fortunately, depending on how that might have turned out.
Although, if we knew you were going to ask that, we would have come up with some great story about how we hung out with him in a bar.
No, was there ever anybody that you had no interest in ever meeting, but you guys met and were just, like, blown away by? Like, as opposed to somebody like, Ralph Steadman, who you actually admired. Was there anybody that you didn't really admire, but then when you met them, you had a whole new appreciation for what they did?
That's a great question. It might not yield a great answer, but
yeah.
Boy.
I think there's certainly people we admired less after we met them.
Yeah. Yeah, I just...
The other way around?
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny. I don't know if Kim remembers this, but... We used to work out of Connecticut, which was a bedroom community.
I remember that.
New York. And we would go into Manhattan a couple of times a week, and they actually had press conferences at Marvel that we would attend, you know, for the Comics Journal. And we would go in there and just see friends and so forth. And I think one time Kim came back from New York, and somehow he was at a party or something, and he met Art Spiegelman. And I was only dimly aware of Art's work. And so Kim described, you know, he met him, and I said, oh, yeah, I kind of remember his work, but I wasn't very familiar with it. Mm-hmm. And then when I went in at some point, I met Art. And the one time I remember, I mean, I'm not sure this is the first time I actually literally met Art, or if it was just among the earliest times, but it was at a party, and... He got into an argument with an editor at Marvel Comics over some war comic they were publishing. And Art was just being ferociously argumentative about this and just how grotesque this war comic was and how the guy was basically immoral for doing it. And so I sort of recognized an immediate kinship there. And so I met Art without really being intimately familiar with what he'd done, you know, because what he'd done previously was really kind of scattered all over the place.
Yeah, that's true.
The arcades and the
Bijou and things,
comics,
yeah.
Books.
Yeah. I mean, there wasn't any one thing that, you know, that I distinctly remember that knocked my socks off. Anyway, you know, and then of course I got to know him and we became fast friends and remain so today. So maybe, you know, oddly enough, Art might fit that category.
Yeah, I know that through reading the journal that you were also great friends with Gil Kane.
Yeah, he was probably my closest friend for about 20 years.
Yeah, because you wrote a really, really lovely piece after he passed away. I really liked that. It was really nice.
Well, thanks. It was heartfelt.
Yeah, you could tell, but he seemed to be a guy that was really critical of everything, too.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's sort of why I guess I got to know him. You know, he did an interview in a fanzine called Alter Ego, which was, again, a pretty good fan magazine in the 60s. And he did an interview which came out somewhere around 1967, something like that, 68. And it just, when I read it, and I must have been pretty young when I read it, it just blew me away, and in fact, it blew everybody away. Mm-hmm. Because he was talking about comics in a way that you would just, that no one had experienced up to that point. He was doing sort of close, what would be the equivalent of close textual readings of mainstream artists, and just parsing, you know, their virtues and vices aesthetically. In a way that really hadn't been done, even by critics of the medium, you know, even by people like Gilbert Seldes and people who had written about comics. and it just knocked people out. And I remember that being a very sort of formative influence on me. And, I mean, Gil was probably a guy I never thought, you know, I'd become close to. He was just this huge, iconic figure in comics. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you know, one of the great craftsmen in mainstream comics.
Oh, definitely.
But, you know, then, I don't know, just worked out.
Yeah. Kim, you got any people you've met that knocked your socks off?
No, I guess they all disappointed me. I guess I can't think of any equivalent. I mean, there's certainly people that I've met and grown very fond of, but generally I was already familiar enough with their work to form an opinion there. And,
Okay. We'll get more into the published works of Fantagraphics. I recently got the catalog of what you guys have coming out for 2007, 2008, fall, winter, and I was blown away at Trump. The Harvey Kurtzman Trump collection coming out.
That's about time.
How did that work out? Yeah, it's about time.
Well, as you know, that was a satirical magazine that Harvey Kurtzman edited and that Hugh Hefner published. And I think that would have been 57, mm-hmm. if I remember correctly. Only two issues of it appeared. It featured work by, the usual gang of people that were around Harvey
Kurtzman
at that time.
Yeah, the usual cast of idiots or whatever they call it.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, Will Elder was in it, Al Jaffe, Wally Wood, Arnold Roth, maybe Jack Davis, I don't remember, Russ Heath. Anyway, you know, Harvey, you know, gathered all these guys together, and they put out only two issues of this magazine. At which point I think Hefner was going through financial difficulties, which always heartens us to hear that. And I guess a bank that he had a loan in was calling in the loan. They were running scared, and they called in the loan, and as a result, he had to cancel Trump. So I don't know off the top of my head if Trump was actually doing well or doing poorly, or even if they knew at the time, but he had to cancel it regardless because it was just a financial burden at that point, and he just couldn't sustain it. So there are two issues of Trump. I think there's 64 pages each. It was a magazine format and very slickly produced. It had some beautiful stuff in it. It had a gatefold that Will Elder did.
Oh, wow.
Had some of Elder's best stuff in it. So it's just a terrific satirical magazine that had great production values, and we're going to be collecting, you know, both those issues in a single volume.
Hmm. Has there ever been anything that you guys have published that say one or either of you have maybe been opposed to, but were convinced into doing it, or like, do you guys usually see fairly eye to eye on things?
Hmm. Yeah, I think we see eye to eye on most of it, but there are certainly things that that Gary publishes that I wouldn't necessarily say I was opposed to publishing, but wasn't fond of, and I'm sure the reverse is true.
I mean, our tastes overlap sufficiently so that I don't think either one of us has ever had a serious objection. I think occasionally we'll look at a project the other one brings in and kind of shrugs. You know, I don't get it, but I trust your taste, and it's obviously not, you know, obviously a bad thing, but I don't quite get it.
And clearly, this is not a case where we'd want to name names.
Not often.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
And this is clearly not a case where we'd want to name names.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Our tastes do coincide to a very large degree.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I'm curious how you've been known for bringing in a lot of like unknown guys that have since catapulted to wonderment, like Dan Clouds. Like, how did you bring in someone who artwork was so odd and just so ugly, great but ugly stuff, and just kind of, how did that happen?
Do you want to name names? Would that be?
Well, I'm just curious how you got Dan Clouds. Like, what attracted to, like, how did you get exposed to his stuff? Like, I mean, he was just previously published in Cracked, and like, I love all that stuff, but
yeah,
it is like
his,
a definitely
his
different.
His work wasn't ugly.
No, it's definitely stylized.
It was highly stylized. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Klaus came in totally over the transom. I mean, Klaus sent us a proposal, and both of us read the proposal, and both of us said, of course.
Oh, really?
There was never any doubt.
Wow. And by saying ugly, I didn't mean it as an insult. I just want to clarify that now. I'm
kind of dark.
I'm a huge Klaus fan.
Yeah, yeah.
You meant that as a compliment.
In all ways, I've hunted down all the cracks I could find and actually got all the pages that he did bound up in a book with all the Lloyd Llewellyn. So
I was trying to rack my brain for artists that were ugly that we published.
All comic artists are pretty boys.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Now, what are some stuff that you want to try and get out there and publish, but you just haven't been able to, I guess, kind of boundaries with, I don't know, like licensing, or just haven't been able to do it yet, or hopefully will do in the future?
Boy, that's another great question that might not yield a very good answer. I'm not sure.
We're all about the awkward pauses here.
Yeah.
You know, I'd like to get some Ronald Searle work back into print.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
You're familiar with him, the British cartoon.
Yeah, he did. He was in a Japanese.
He did the
internment
camp. To the Kwai'an back. That was him.
Yeah, he did a book about the death march in Bataan.
Yeah,
the Bataan death march. I mean, as well as a lot of really, you know, light, humorous work.
Yeah, children's books.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah, I mean, Arnold Roth was obviously influenced heavily by Searle, I think. Yeah.
I think Stedman was too.
Yeah,
Stedman. Yeah,
definitely.
I mean, he sort of took it in a different direction. You know, much more savage direction, but yeah.
And in some case, persistence
has
just paid off.
The only reason he's done that is because, you know, of lack of time. No real impediment other than, you know, we haven't gotten around to it yet.
Yeah.
I don't know. Kim, can you think of anything?
I mean, it took a long time to get Peanuts, for instance.
Oh, yeah, that must
have
been. So
if you'd asked us, like, eight or nine or ten years ago, that would have been on the list of ones that we wanted but hadn't been able to get yet. For that matter, even Swart. I mean, I remember discussing with Swart the idea of packaging his material, I think, 15 years ago. And we just couldn't get a workable format together and had to abandon it with some disappointment.
Mm. So, yeah, Bill Malden is a cartoonist that has been in the back of my mind for, like, literally 10 or 15 years.
Oh, yeah, I've got that big book that they put out, the big white one that had, like, 300 pages of his stuff. I just love it.
Yeah.
Now, the Peanuts collection, actually, that's something we should mention, because that's one of the more prominent titles that people will know. That originally, he didn't want to print all of them. Am I correct? Am I remembering?
You are mostly correct. He wasn't taken by my suggestion to print the complete Peanuts. And because he wasn't fond of a lot of the earliest work.
Because I interviewed Seth, and that was actually my first one for the show, and he said, like, the only way he really do it, he wasn't able to until, like, you guys were able to print all of them, because he's only interested in really doing it as, like, a whole epic thing, I think. So,
that I was only interested in doing?
No, Seth was saying that he was, like, part of doing the design work for us. He didn't want to just do, like, a partial Peanuts collection. He wanted to work on, like, the whole Peanuts collection.
Oh, I see. I don't think a partial Peanuts collection was ever in the cards.
Yeah.
We were always about the complete Peanuts.
Yeah. Yeah, you guys have done quite a few things like that. You did the Prince Valiant years ago, didn't you?
That's true.
Yeah.
We did
Popeye?
We did basically the complete Hal Foster Prince Valiant, at least. And we did do the complete Seeger Popeye.
Yeah, and I remember I had the, Terry and the Pirates, Dickie Dare, the Dickie Dare book.
Right.
Is that something you're trying to do, like a balance? Because you are publishing a lot of strip reprints right now. Is trying to balance between having new stuff and also exposing people to this great old stuff?
Yeah.
I'm not sure we plan it out quite that closely. I mean, we do as many classics as we feel like, and we do as much new stuff as we feel like.
And then after we figure that out, we try to balance it.
I put in more thoughts to my questions than need be.
Actually, I was wondering, with things like Peanuts, they're a little bit more in sort of the mainstream. Like basically, they probably sell pretty book or pretty good, I'm assuming, through bookstores.
Yeah.
Is that affected the way you run the company now? Like the difference between being able to get some things into bookstores as opposed through a comic distributor? Or?
Well, it. Yes and no. It allows us to publish work that'll sell well in bookstores and that wouldn't sell well in comic stores. I mean, if we couldn't sell, I don't know. I mean, obviously, this couldn't happen because bookstores would want to sell peanuts. But if we couldn't sell peanuts in bookstores, we'd be selling about a tenth of what we're selling.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it allows us to sell something that will do well in bookstores. You know, and as a publishing company, we need a balance of, you know, work like Peanuts or Popeye or Bill Malden, mm-hmm. Work that will do well in a larger market, something close to a mass market, as opposed to the smaller, you know, more specialized, more minority interest books that we do also. Hmm. So we have to strike a balance, I think, between those two.
It's the monetary balance, I guess, because I understand a lot of titles don't necessarily make money, and that's kind of just putting it out because it's such a quality product.
That's correct. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a financial balance, not an aesthetic one. I mean, aesthetically,
exactly.
You know, people had an attitude that we published alternative comics, and by that they meant sort of edgy, you know, material that might have been, you know, more sexual or whatever.
Marginalized or something.
Yeah, and that was never really our criterion. Our sole criterion was good cartooning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I remember you guys, you put out Nemo magazine too, didn't you?
We did,
yeah. Because even that at the time was, you were kind of doing both, you know.
Yeah. And we did the start of the Prince Valiant and did the first Popeyes really quite early on in our careers, as it were.
That was like 83, 84, was it?
Yeah, it was definitely the early 80s, so just a couple of years after we started publishing books.
Yeah, I think Popeye could have been as early as 83.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we did certainly also the first of our foreign editions in 83 or 84. So we had all those ideas bubbling under pretty early on.
Which were the first foreign editions that you did?
It was actually an action-adventure comic that we retitled The Survivors, but the original was called Jeremiah.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, oddly enough, there was a TV series of it a few years ago, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, by Herman.
Oh, okay.
I'm curious, going back and talking about publishing and distribution through Booksource, I'm wondering how, this might be too obscure for recent readers of comics, but back in the 90s, I guess 96, a bunch of distributors went kaput because of Marvel trying to be a little bit greedy, and from the end of it, Diamond stood up on top. How has that affected what you guys decide to do?
It hasn't.
Has it? It hasn't affected, like, I was
wondering. It didn't affect, like, back in the day, you just kind of.
I was wondering about adult material, because I know we've had problems just bringing. I work at a comic store, and we've had problems bringing things up from the States just because they've deemed it adult for whatever reason, whether it is or not. And
Canada.
Well, that's because of your country, right? Not Diamond.
Yeah.
No, that's our border guards.
By the time Diamond became the Monopoly distributor, it had grown to love smut.
Oh, okay.
They pretty much did a 180 over the years. They were real conservative at one point. They were literally refusing to carry even not pornographic, but just relatively extreme alternative comics like Yummy Fur. Mm-hmm. And as things went on, whether because of greed or because of a more enlightened viewpoint, they turned around and essentially now they'll carry pretty much anything.
Oh, okay.
I'm sure it was
enlightened. Which helps us because sometimes we publish just about anything.
Okay.
I think we're nearing the end of our time. I guess we should remind people you do have the eBay auctions, and Barry Windsor Smith has generously donated a couple of nice pieces. Is he still a pretty close friend of Fantagraphics, I guess?
He is an absolutely terrific guy, and I'm pleased to say he's a great friend of Fantagraphics. You know, I've known Barry since I was like 15.
Oh, really?
So over a substantial part of our lives.
Here's a question I can kind of skirt around the whole lawsuit thing is, has this been a time where you've kind of seen who your friends really are? And is this kind of the same as like when back in, I guess, with the other 80s. Lawsuit in the 80s, the Fleischer one, you kind of see who are the friends and who are the supporters?
I'm not sure we've seen any huge surprises, although the degree to which some people have stepped forward has been has been touching and heartening.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's pretty. I mean, I wouldn't want to say. I mean,
no names.
If someone, you know, hasn't contributed, doesn't mean he's not a friend. I mean, he might cannot contribute for whatever reason.
Well, comic artists don't make a lot of money, so.
Yeah. But certainly, you know, there have been artists who have just given us material. I mean, Barry being one of them. Art Spiegelman, for example, he signed at my booth at APE at the convention in San Francisco a few weeks ago, and he sat there for 3 hours and signed until I thought his arm was going to fall off.
Awesome. I bid on that breakdown you guys had on the auction, but it went well above my affordable price range.
Some artists have just been so incredibly generous that, you know, I feel terribly guilty in the face of such generosity.
Yeah, we donated some stuff when we were down there. And
That's right.
And we got a pretty penny for them on eBay, as I recall.
Oh, good.
Yeah,
that's what it was for.
Except for the one that we didn't think much.
Actually, you know what? I was gonna mention if you guys wanted to raise some money, I was thinking at San Diego you should get like a dunk tank, or maybe have like a kissing booth or something. You know.
Kim could go in the dunk tank. I could go in the kissing.
Booth. Yeah. Exactly.
You're on.
Thank you very much, guys, and I hope you have an excellent day.
Well, you're welcome.
Okay, take care.
All right, thanks. Bye-bye.
Thanks, bye. That was the men behind Fantagraphics, Gary Groth and Kim Thompson, both wonderful, talented, great editors. Oh, I just remembered a couple questions I was going to ask. That's okay.
Okay.
We'll live. I want to talk about some of the shows we got coming up. We have some fantastic shows ahead of us.
Fantastic.
Next week, I will be playing an interview that Don and I did last month with Melinda Gebbie,
who is the wife of Alan Moore, fiancé. Mr. Alan Moore. And
well, she is the artist of Lost Girls. That's how I'm going to refer to it.
I know, but people know Lost Girls off the top of their head because of the controversy, and it's Alan Moore.
It's a fantastic book, and Melinda really went over the top on the artwork.
She did some really nice stuff in there.
It's a lifetime thing. Also, just remind people, if they want to check out Fantagraphics, fantagraphics.com. I'll be linking in on the website. Frank
or the Comics Journals. It's
TCJ.com.
TCJ.com. TheComicsJournal.com.
Yeah. .com.
.com.
Let's see. The week after, I don't know who I'm going to interview yet. I have something in mind, but I'm not saying anything until it pans out. Future interviews will include John Porcellino, whose King Cat collection is awesome.
Spit and a Half. Check him out.
Baron Story.
I'm fantastic really looking artist. Forward to Baron Story.
Both of us are very big Baron Story fanatics. He influenced Dave McKeon, Bill Sienkiewicz, David Mack, Kent Williams, George Pratt, John Muth.
He's a killer graphic designer. He's stellar. Good.
I wouldn't call him graphic designer. He's an illustrator. He's not a graphic designer.
That's true. He's an illustrator.
Damn you, Dodd!
But we're also looking forward to Eddie Campbell.
Eddie Campbell, who's a new book that's coming out soon, The Black Diamond Detective Agency, I just read. Fantastic. I tried to get Don to read it, but he refuses to touch it till he can buy it himself.
Yeah, I want my own, so I can get my stains all over it.
Fantastic book coming out from First Second.
Most people would probably know Eddie Campbell for the one that illustrated From Hell with Alan Moore. But I actually like his own stuff better.
His Alex story is fantastic. Bacchus, I've been reading and quite enjoying. He's just good.
He's awesome. Just excellent. He's my top five. Where's Bougie? This is my top five. Eddie Campbell's one of my top five creators of all time. My favorite.
Yes, Don.
It's true.
There we go. Oh, jeez, I'm classless.
At least you did that on the air. So.
Yeah, that was just for your Don. Yeah. Who else? What else? Oh, yeah, there's some sales happening in town. Last Saturday was Free Comic Day, and it was a fun day. I picked up some good stuff. The Toronto Comics Festival thing was excellent. And you know what? I wish I lived in Toronto because they put on a good show, it sounds like. On that note, the next Vancouver Comic Con will be
June 3rd
with Kerry Nord as the artist. He
illustrates Conan.
I'm a big fan of his Daredevil stuff. I don't really care about Conan.
The Conan, first 25 issues of Conan that he did with Kurt Busiek are fantastic. Even if you hate Conan, give him a try. You might actually like it.
I don't wear a loincloth and don't swing a battle axe.
Well, either do I, but I always thought.
Don is lying. He's wearing nothing but a.
Conan used to be lame. And then when I read that, I thought, you know what? This is what kind of makes them interesting, and they finally went back to that. But anyway, enough about that.
Enough Enough. May 31st, Scott McCloud will be on the show joining us as well that night. He's doing a signing and
at Sophia's Books.
At Sophia's Books, 7 p.m. I will be there. He'll be with his family, part of his Scott McCloud road trip around America and Canada. He is going up to where is he going up to?
He's going
to
do his Alaska. He's going to do his aristocrats tour. Anyway,
okay. What else? Oh yeah, sales in stores in town. I just thought I'd let you guys know. Book and Comic Emporium is blowing everything out. 50% off everything. Go crazy for what's left. There's not a lot of great stuff left, but it's a good store.
Oh, also
kind
of. If you're looking for any of some of the leftovers from Free Comic Day, I know RX Comics has a few. We have a bunch of stuff sitting there
Dawn's
by the door.
Plug.
That's my plug. I got to have a plug.
As well, Sophia Books, where we will be at the signing for Scott McCloud. Next week, the 17th, I almost forgot to mention, Nagadod signing with Mark Bell.
At Lucky's?
No, at Sophia's.
Oh, at Sophia's, really?
At Sophia's. I think Luke Ramsey will be there, and Luke Ramsey's doing some fantastic stuff. Really, it's going to be a great group of people. I am looking forward to it. I'm going to get some good comics, I guess, or art chat books. Really good stuff.
Lots of good books coming out lately.
Yeah, Sophia Books is having a sale right now, 30% off everything. So you can go buy a bunch of stuff for cheap.
And actually, if you want to support Fantagraphics, just buy some good Fantagraphics books. There's no shortage of them anywhere.
Yeah, I'll be honest. Comic companies don't make a lot of money. Not that I'm doing the hard sell, and we're not sponsored by any comic store or comic company.
No.
Fantagraphics puts out some quality work, and I really highly recommend going out.
They've been probably one of the most consistent American publishers of comic books for the last 20 years. So
They're fantastic.
They're Fantagraphic casting. Lame. Anyway.
Okay. So thank you, Gary and Kim, for joining us. And now I shall end off with first song we played was Gary's Request. I forgot the name of the artist. It was something French, and the song was Summer Wind. I'm going to end with France Gall. I don't even know how to pronounce this song. You'll recognize it.
It's